Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's April 29th, 2016. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We are home. We have our sea legs.
Apparently I'm nasally today, according to my co-host.
We're both nasally. I think there's something going on in the air.
I will tell you, I had a massive allergy attack yesterday, so maybe that's it. Pollen here in Florida.
Yeah, pollen. I can't get rid of it. Just when I think I'm over the other crap, I get something else. It's just killing me. So we're back from the cruise.
We are.
It was very fun, very exciting, very successful. Had a good time. And one of the things that success breeds is more success.
Fingers crossed.
When you're looking forward to future cruises with us, the Alaskan cruise is going to be great. And we've already sold out of our inside cabins. I'm not trying to turn this into a commercial, but people on the ship, on the cruise, were booking that cruise because they didn't want to miss out. So,
to clarify, we sold out of our initial allotment of insides.
Right.
We have more now at slightly higher price. So, but when they are gone, we absolutely will not be able to get more.
Yeah. So if you're thinking about coming with us and having a good time like we did this week, last week, you know, you better call Jeannie now because they're going to go. And it's a lot of the, we still have a lot of the, like, the balconies and stuff like that, because that's a lot of people, you think that's what they're going to want when they go to Alaska anyway. And those are our contract rates. So make sure you call her. Phone's ringing constantly here. So
that's good to hear.
Yeah. But it was a great cruise, and I hardly played at all.
I did a bunch of hit and runs. And apparently I hit more than I ran this time. So
actually, I wouldn't call them hit and runs. I call them hit and booted.
And brooded it.
Because Scott and I never take a seat away from anyone who's actually a cruiser and wants to play. We just start games because we want people to be able to play games. But if the table's full and someone comes in and wants to play the game we're playing, we're up. Whether we're up winning or losing, it doesn't matter. We get up and they sit down. So it was so busy this week, or last week, I keep saying that. But it was so busy that you and I really, we get in, we play a few hands, make a hit here and there, and then, oh, Chris, we got to get your seat. All right. You can have it, and I'd get up and sell my chips to that person or whatever, and it was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was, and obviously we talked at nauseam last week on last week's short phone-in show that we always do on the cruise ship about the cruise, but there was a couple stuff that happened afterwards that we wanted to bring up on this one, and I think your situation is probably more interesting because it's just so crazy. But
it is.
We'll start with my boring one and work the crescendo up.
Yeah, we'll peek at my my story, but it's not really my story. It's just I'm going to tell it for someone.
Right. Well, you're going to tell it, so yeah. You own it. You own the retelling of the story. So my story, which I don't own either, other than I own the audio retelling of it right now, is that our main event. It's always kind of fun because I'm usually in the room during the day, so I'm watching the tournaments and helping out with them. And it came down to heads up, one of our new cruisers and one of our regular cruisers, and our regular cruiser, Brent, he actually plays for a living. I'm not gonna see him on TV or anything, but he's been very successful at the 2-5 grind. That's very hard for other people to be successful at. But he has a policy, and he never wavers from it, that he does not chop. He doesn't do bubble saves, he doesn't do anything. He's in it to play it out, and you know, if he gets bubbled because he didn't do a bubble save and he gets nothing, gets up, walks away. No big deal, right?
Mm.
We all know that. And then he also is very clear with it whenever a chop discussion comes up with folks. And he's very nice about it. He's like, you know, hey, you know, just a policy. I do it all the time, not just you guys. So I don't remember whether a CHOP discussion came up at all on this one until Heads Up. And his opponent actually said, hey, why don't you just take 200 off first? So you get everything off first place, minus 200. And I'll get the 200 plus second place money, and we'll end it now. And Brent, almost knee-jerk, said, you know, hey, I'm sorry, I just don't CHOP. I appreciate your understanding, blah, 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 blah. And the guy's like, all right, cool, we'll play it out. So immediately after that is when Brent, who usually knows everybody's chips on the table at all times, it's really amazing, actually, he's like, wow, you had me, like, way out chipped when you just offered that. It's probably really a bad mistake for me to have passed up that deal. And I think he actually thought about it for a while. And so he ended up winning, so it ended up being the right decision for him. But I think it was an interesting situation where you have this policy in your mind, and it's good to be, and no matter whether it's chopping or raising 5x with ace ace or whatever it is, that you still have to remain flexible, I think, and stop and before you do your knee jerk to actually consider the entire situation. And, you know, I mean, what if the guy offered him everything for first minus $1, just a token thing, right?
Yeah,
like he's the CEO of Twitter or something, right? But if you're stuck on that thing, hey, I never chop, that's probably a bad deal, right?
Yeah, I think within reason he would chop. I mean, I think that he's just, you know, it's just the way he likes to play. He likes to, and that's how he gets to be so good as he is that he forces himself to finish these things off and figure out the other player, regardless of what type of player they are or with regards to chip stacks. And maybe he looks at it as sort of a, I wouldn't say punishment, but maybe just sort of a way of getting better, that if he doesn't beat the person, then I don't deserve to win, and I'm going to strive to be better at winning. You know, whatever. I don't know what his self-motivation is, but I like somebody who can have a set plan and stick with it, but then revise it when something obvious is in front of you that needs revision. So, but that was remarkable. When I heard the chip stacks, the difference in the stacks, and then the offer he got, it's like, just end it. You're on a cruise ship. Go have some fun. You know, but he got that extra, whatever it was, $200, I guess. So.
But I'll say this, too, before we move on to your more interesting story, too. I think it's a good lesson in life, too, that when you compromise too much, then it becomes easier. You know, anytime you do anything once, then you have more confidence in it next time, right?
Yeah.
And the opposite, too. You know, I would say the first time you rob a bank and get away with it, then it's easier for you to rob the bank the second time, right?
Yeah.
So I think the same thing, too, here. If you just automatically, yeah, let's chop when everybody says chop, it becomes easier to do it the next time. And then you find yourself at a final table where you have to play it out, and you realize you've never played five-handed, four-handed,
yeah,
three-handed, or heads up. And now you can't go back to all those 27 tournaments beforehand where you gave up that opportunity and get that experience back now when you actually need it. So.
Right.
It's interesting just to think about, you know, what you're, even if the money sounds good, what you're actually giving up in a deal sometimes.
And it goes back to even like just actual poker fundamentals. How you and I have discussed often on the show that you go into a flop with a plan, or you go into a hand with a plan, and then something else presents itself. You have to be willing to change that plan. You know, oh, I'm going to shove on this flop, and then, you know, all of a sudden, bingo, bango, bongo. You've made quads, and why would you shove when you're going to make more money? You don't just shove because you said to yourself, I'm going to shove. You know, something presented itself to you that is a better outcome or whatever. So, yeah, always willing to be flexible, but, you know, have a plan.
Right.
This is an interesting situation that happened in our poker room, and we had a real very good bunch of people on the ship. Even, like, when there was someone who was being contentious, then that, you found out later that person was just ill-informed or something, and then turned out to be a good person. And it was a really good bunch of people. There was really no complaints. It was just a great time. So this situation was really peculiar, and I ended up becoming good friends with this person by the end of the cruise, too. We hung out and talked and played and stuff. And so now, in our poker room on the ship, we only offer the straddle under the gun.
Right.
We don't do the button straddle on all the Mississippi, all that
the
stuff.
The way it should be.
And even then, it's, you know, whatever. But yeah, people are used to seeing that, so they want to make the game bigger. Whatever they want to do, we let them do it. So the straddle had been going on for at least a day or two without any comments about it. And one of the players came over to us. You, Ramsey, and I were sitting in the corner of the poker room just waiting for seats to be filled or run chips or whatever we do for the ship, or the cruise, I mean. And the guy walks up to us and says, "Hey, if I straddle, does that mean I'm last to act?" And we said, "Yeah, in the first round, yeah, you're last to act." He says, "Well, will you tell your dealer that? Because they didn't give me the option to act last, and I want my straddle money back." And so we said, that needs investigating. So he was all confident that he was right, and we were like, yeah, you're right, you know, because that's all we heard from the story. We didn't get all the details. So Ramsey, our poker room manager, decided to walk over there and investigate. And as he's walking over there, one of the other players pipes up and says, "Yeah, but not when someone raises." And we're like, "Oh, wait a minute. So, wait, you're saying that you were the under-the-gun straddler, and then it went like call, call, and then got to another player who raised, and now you still think you get to act last?" And he's like, "Yeah." So what he was saying was that he thought if he was the under-the-gun straddler, let's say it's a 1-3 game and he's made it 6 to go with the straddle, and then there's two players in middle position who call the straddle, and then let's say the button gets, you know, a hand that he wants to raise with and raises to like 30. Well, this straddle person is saying that the small and big blind will have to act on that $30 raise, but then it skips the straddler and goes back to the other $6 callers who are in middle position. They can make up their mind if they want to call the 30, you know, the $30 raise.
Right.
And then it goes back to him. And then he can make his decision.
Yeah, we were nicknaming this the ultimate straddle, I think. Ultimate last act.
Ultimate position, I think, is what they called it. Ultimate position was one of the... And it wasn't only nicknamed that, but when we were discussing it like the next day, one of the dealers that we hired piped up, I think it was a dealer, and said, "Yeah, they've done that in our room where they call it ultimate position or something." And Scott's played in more poker rooms than anyone, I think. I've played in probably the second most poker rooms. And then Ramsey's, you know, I mean, he's been doing this forever as a dealer, floor, manager. And we had never, ever, ever heard of that.
Yeah.
And now here's the deal. We told the guy, we assured him, we are not saying that he's wrong or that he's lying or anything like that. We just have never heard of it. So he says, "Well, in all of my Oklahoma rooms that I play in, I play in 4 of them." And he mentioned Choctaw and Windstar, which you and I have been to and played in. And he said, "They do it there." And I said, "Wow. I don't remember hearing about that at all." I said, "So, you know, you play there all the time, so you know if that's what you're saying they do there, you know, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I would really like to hear from other people about this to see if they've actually seen this before." Because when we harp on the straddle on this show, you know, it's because of we're trying to avoid confusion most of the time, and we think it's just most of the time it's just ridiculous. You're just trying to make people uncomfortable, or you're trying to make things difficult or whatever, and then trying to make them bigger, whatever the reason is. But we always sort of harp on it because we don't like it to interfere with the flow of the game. We don't want any confusion when we're playing. We want to play as many hands as possible and be comfortable and whatever. This would be the most catastrophic, you know. I mean, first of all, what you're doing is you're confusing everyone. You're getting out of the clockwise rotation that is, and there's no reason why, because you were willing to put up $3 extra, why you should now get this special attention, wishful thinking.
It's like the super idol on Survivor.
Exactly. It's like putting two things, like, you know, because you put up $3 extra, but the worst part of this, other than it just being absolutely impossible to follow, you know, okay, let's jump this guy and then go backwards, and that doesn't work that way. Things go clockwise on a poker table all the time. But the worst part to me is that if you say to someone, "Hey, let's be partners. I'm going to sit in seat 2. You're going to sit in seat 8. Okay? I'm going to straddle. When it gets to you, when we get a couple of callers in between, you raise. We're going to get it back. It's going to jump to me. These guys are now going to decide to either call that raise or fold. But if they fold, well, now we've worked in a way that we can get their money because it's always dead money. If they decide to call, when all the action's over, now it's going to come back to me, and now I'm just going to shove.
Right. Yeah.
And so you're talking about this huge collusional problem that you can't avoid now. Because all you got to do is have a partner on the opposite end of the table, and they're going to collude. They could collude. Or at least it would be a situation that is very unsavory and would raise a lot of questions when that
kind of thing happened. Well, even beyond that, what we were talking about is, if that was allowed, and again, I think one of the dealers that's telling us about it actually said that she's seen it in those Oklahoma rooms, but only on one table or two tables. So it's not like the room policy.
Okay.
It's, you know, like if you want to do a 2-5 rock game or something, there's one there, and then there's a normal 2-5 game somewhere else, right?
Right.
But if you are doing it, you know, what Ramsey and I are talking about, why would you ever not want to straddle?
Right.
If I could be the ultimate last action, watch everything happen, bets, 3 bets, 4 bets, whatever at the table, and then I get to decide at that point what I want to do with my hand, why would I ever give up that power for $3?
Yep.
Or $5 or whatever the straddle is? I mean, that's immensely powerful.
It is. It's absolutely it's the most strategic, and on top of
I don't understand how you could lose. I guess if you had everybody in there that was strategic about it, then it would be the most boring game ever, right? Because the straddler would just win pot that he straddled in, and then everybody else would stay out of the rest of pots, right?
Yeah.
Because if I'm in the game, I'm not going to enter any pot that I'm not straddling. But when I'm straddling, I'm probably getting it all in almost every time, I think, right?
Close to that.
I don't really understand how I could lose money in a game like that, assuming the other people at the table didn't understand how powerful this power really is.
Yeah.
And obviously, if people are playing this, it's either one, as you mentioned, because they've got a buddy in the game and they figured out the collusion, and let's hope that's not the case, but that's obviously one reason people would want to play it. Or two, they don't really understand how much this changes the game, and they're probably not playing optimally because of it.
Right.
So if I can get into that game, then I think it's almost impossible to lose money, I think. I mean, obviously, you know, there is the element of luck in poker beyond that. But, you know, get all in, even if I, let's say, had aces, you know, get all in, somebody with 7-2 could, you know, flop 2-bet like any hand, right?
Right.
But I think over the course, again, long term, which is how we rate poker, I don't know how you could lose in a game like that. It's just, it bastardizes the game to such a ridiculous level.
And to get back to the collusion part of it, too, it's when you enter a poker room and you play at a poker table, you have an expectation of protection.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, now, whether or not...
in a poker room and not in, Joe's basement.
Yeah. I mean, we understand that a sucker, you know, is born every minute and, you know, can't... those sayings about, you know, if you, you know, deserve to lose your money or whatever. But, no, we're not talking about that. We're talking about you're going into a situation where you're playing... even if it's not even regulated by a gaming commission, the rules of poker are set up to protect you. That's the thing. This is like violating the rule of poker. That it's like saying all of a sudden, well, sorry, a straight beats a flush.
Yeah.
Because the rule of poker is that flush beats straights because they're harder to make. And so if you're telling me now that we're not going to go clockwise on this table and that you're getting this fantastic power because you blindly put in $3 extra than you have to play a hand? Why do you get rewarded for that? It's okay because you decide to put in $3 blind that you'll get that last if no one raises because it's the natural order of things, but it's still clockwise. I mean, imagine if that straddle, now you're doing it Mississippi straddle, where now you want to straddle, but I want to straddle. Well, we're both straddling. So which straddler gets to act last? Well, we both straddled. Well, you know, it's a nightmare. And if they really do have this game, I would really like people to contact us and tell us about it. Right. I mean, I don't know if we're going to how far we would take it, but I would really like to have someone explain it to me, the how they do it and how it doesn't create problems and why people play it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would love to hear it.
Well, something else that just debuted that also is very different from poker is the Action Clock. This was made by a company called Protection Poker, and it debuted while we were on the cruise, actually. Not on the cruise, but right. At the World Poker Tour Tournament of Champions. And it sounds like the reaction was largely positive. So here's how it works. Players had 30 seconds to act on their hand, and they also got 4 30-second extensions that they could use at any time. The time is kept on an iPad Pro at the table, with the dealer tapping a button each time a player finishes his or her action. And if the clock gets zero, player's hand is killed. One suggestion from a player, instead of killing the hand, automatically take one of the extension chips. So we talked a little bit about this with some players on the cruise because people heard that it was going on. And the reaction there, I think, was generally very positive, too. I think what happened is people are just tired of tankers. And it's become a real problem in the last couple of years on the tournament circuit where, you know, somebody just decides that they want to spend 3 hours on a hand. And so, and sometimes you need it. Not 3 hours, obviously. But sometimes you need a lot of time. But people just started doing it as a matter of practice. And then it's like anything else that's trendy. People look at them like, oh, hey, he's spending a lot of time on hand. You know what? I'm going to spend a lot of time on hand. Or, that guy's driving me insane by spending 20 minutes on his hand. So to get back at him, I'm going to spend 20 minutes on my hand. And next thing you know, tournaments are lasting 47 days.
Or at least you're not getting a lot of hands per round.
Exactly.
Or per level.
So I think it's an interesting development. It sounds like the implementation of it was very smooth, which is one of the concerns I always had, is how do you do these clocks? And sounded like I didn't hear any complaints about dealers not being able to use it. In fact, actually, some of the articles I read said the dealers, they had a little training class beforehand, but they all seemed to pick it up right away. So it does seem pretty seamless, and as somebody like me that does like to act fairly quickly, I had no problems with it, but I'm wondering in the general poker, gentleman's agreement we have at poker, whether this is a bastardization like this ultimate last act straddle.
Well, first I want to say a couple of things, but this makes it sound like this is an invention that just happened, but
right, exactly.
Like, I mean, I just watched an Aria High Roller where they had the same thing, where they had to throw in cards for 30-second extensions. So it was very similar to this. I don't know. This makes it sound like it's never happened before, but I've seen shot clocks on poker for years.
No, I should clarify that the Poker News story where I first saw this and other people wrote about it, that they were clear that this has been done at other places.
Okay.
This is the first time that the action clock by Protection Poker has been used.
Okay. Because, yeah, I mean, I remember, I think it was just a little while ago, right before I went on the cruise, I watched the Aria High Roller on TV, and they had, I think that's what it was, the Aria tournament, and they had those little cards, and one guy used, like, all four of them on one hand, and then he made the right call. It was phenomenal, but it was...
Well, that's just part of the strategy, right?
Yeah, and of course, on the next hand, he gave back all the chips he had just won with that thing, so it was really depressing. What I want to say is, I don't think that you can bastardize tournament poker. Because I don't think tournament poker is poker.
That's probably a good point, actually.
I think that it's a tournament, so they've said, hey, this is the way we're going to run tournaments. There's clocks on tournaments. There's no clocks in cash games, unless you call someone over and say, hey, this guy's taking forever. Let's.
Right.
But tournaments are made by time. Without time, you don't have a tournament.
That's correct.
So if you are going to manipulate that time, I don't see how it's bastardizing it. I love this idea. I think it's fantastic. I think in basketball, there's time. And there's a clock counting down. And if you want to stop that clock, you get 5 timeouts if you're in the NBA or whatever it is. And that's how you stop the clock. Well, hey, this is poker, and there's time. So you want to stop that clock, or you want to take a lot of our time? Because you're affecting our time now. I love this idea. I think it's a great idea. So I don't really know if it could bastardize, because whatever you do to tournament poker, it's a tournament. You could do whatever you want to a tournament. That's the beauty of it. Now, if you say I have to walk into your cash game and say, hey, if you want to think longer on this, you got to donate $1, and you know, then we're talking about bastardizing poker, I think, because there's no time limit in a cash game other than it's getting annoying. You know, but how many times do people take that long in a cash game? Tournament, and even if you do, you're like, hey, it's all right. You know, I mean, unless you're playing in a timed rake, which almost nobody does anymore, unless you're doing it for really big, you know, buy-ins or whatever. You know, then what do you care if this guy's taking 40 more seconds to make his decision, and he's not going to take 4 hours? This is a cash game. Right. So Yeah, I like the idea of this clock. I liked it when I saw it, you know, when I watched it on TV. I don't know if you remember, but years ago they had the... It was like Rush Poker almost, but it was live. And they had this sort of button in front of them, and it had a red line that went right to the dealer or something, like a lighted up thing on the table. It was lit up or something. And then you see it counting down toward them as the 15 seconds were going down. And they had like one... They tried to make like it was like an online. You know, like when you're online, you had to hit the extension or whatever when you're playing on. They tried to make it like that on TV. And it was exciting. It was like, holy cow, this tournament's going to be over in 20 minutes, you know, or whatever it was. And it made me want to watch. It made me want to see these guys make fast decisions. Make decisions like I had to make when I was playing online, you know? So I enjoy this thing. I think this is good for poker. I think you can get a lot more hands in, and you know, and there might be more to watch on television that way, because you're not going to be seeing all this. You know, I know they edit things out, but there's only so many hands that they can show on TV. Then if you're not having that many played, whereas this forces them to play a lot more.
So one giggle I had over this is after the cruise, the night we got off the ship, took Ramsey to a baseball game here, and he wasn't aware of the new pitch clock that's being used now, right?
Oh, yeah.
Baseball. And he was like, "You gotta be kidding me. You get 30 seconds to act on your hand in poker, but 15 seconds to throw a pitch?" And I'm like, "All right, man, fair enough." So the other thing I want to ask is, and I forget which player it was that made the suggestion, but the one I mentioned here, instead of killing your hand, you automatically take one of your extension chips. That seems to be a pretty fair compromise, I think.
Sure. Because that way, you're kind of not interfering with the game of poker, because you're letting the hand still be played, which is what's in, you know, someone's hand shouldn't be killed because of time. But at the same time, they should be punished for not following the rules of that tournament, and that's a good way to do it, rather than killing the hand.
Yeah, I think a couple things about this. One, I mean, that player mentioned, you know, hey, I've got a lot going on when I'm making a decision. Now I got to add in looking over at this iPad Pro by the dealer and watching the clock tick down, right?
Right.
So I get that, although I think she lost my argument when she said something about headphones or something. I'm like, get away.
Yeah.
Headphones are never going to be an argument that's going to win with me, right?
Right.
But the other thing, too, is I think, you know, if you go to our call the floor segment on that, I mean, one of the things that the really good tournament directors are all in agreement on is you try to do anything you can to avoid killing a hand. You know, if you can retrieve the proper cards from the muck, or whatever you can do to actually reconstruct it, to keep from killing a hand, that's the goal, generally speaking. And so the fact that the default here is to kill the hand when you have, or you may have, these extension chips behind you, it seems a no-brainer to me to let's kill the hand once you're out of those things.
Yes, exactly.
Until then, you're just going to keep taking those chips away. And, you know, some players are not going to be able to understand how this works, and that's fine, and they're going to have to get used to it. But that does seem like a very good compromise to me.
I agree. You know, it's the equivalent of having a floor supervisor standing over you and you've had the clock called on you. When he says you have a minute to act in your hand and it's going to be dead, you have that minute. Well, in this case, you don't have that person lurching over you. But when you're out of these four cards, your hand will be dead. So now the interesting thing that happens after that, you know, when you don't have any extensions, now you've got 30 seconds and that's it. And if you don't act,
but at that point, I think now you're aware that
you
don't have that crutch anymore. And now, as much as you find it troubling to do all the things you need to do to make your decision and have to watch the clock, you at least know now I have to watch the clock. Whereas all the other times that you might be in the situation, which could be 20, 30, 40 during the tournament, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you're worried about the clock, that takes it away. So there's only one time that you actually in the tournament have to really be concerned with that clock.
Yep.
So
very good.
All right, moving on. Another news tidbit this week. A federal judge has given the Iowa Tribe of Oklahoma final approval to start an online gaming site that could track players from around the world. No official word yet on when the tribe will launch its site, but estimates range from anywhere from August 1st to the end of the year.
That's good. We've mentioned this before, right? It's moving through now.
Yeah, we'll just see what happens with it. I think what everybody's kind of wondering is, you know, what kind of player liquidity they can get here. Obviously, they're not limited to a geographic area, I don't believe, like the folks in Delaware or New Jersey or Nevada. So, eventually could open up the world. And there's a ton of poker players in the world, right?
Yeah.
The problem is, though, as we've seen back before Black Friday and everything, people gravitated to PokerStars with Full Tilt. That's where the games were. So these little tiny sites like Joe's Online Poker often went out of business because no one wants to be on a site that has no games. So just because you can appeal to the entire world doesn't mean the entire world is going to come to your site to play.
No. But would our country be enough? Because only three states in this country are...
Yeah, and I guess so. I'm still a little confused on who they can actually market it to in the states.
Yeah, because they can't do it in the states, then.
This might just be, you know, if you're on a tribal land, then you can play.
Hmm.
I don't know quite yet. But I think the big challenge for them is going up against the bigger sites around the world.
Yeah.
To really do something to get people to want to play on a smaller site, or at least a site that starts out smaller.
All right, any updates? Our most popular dealer contest is back, and this year we've opened nominations to anyone who wishes to nominate a dealer. If you're a dealer or know one worthy of recognition, go to anteupmagazine.com/MPD through May 23rd to complete the nomination application. Winning dealer gets an Anteup Poker Cruise package for two for our November 14th sailing out of Tampa, and the top five will get prize packages that include a pair of Blue Shark optics. Also, it's time to build up our bench of possible Anteup ambassadors. If you'd like to be one of our monthly magazine contributors and represent Anteup in your home area, apply at anteupmagazine.com/ambassadors. We have immediate openings in Michigan, Louisiana, and the Pacific Northwest. All right, each week we spotlight a listener who emails us at podcast@anteupmagazine.com, and if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something cool. This week's prize is an upgraded membership to PokerRadius.com, poker's best social networking site, and home of the Anteup Group discussions. I'm almost completely awake. All right, Dave Beeson writes in, says, I was in a $2 tournament. I worked my way up to chip leader with 180,000 chips, and we were 40 or 50 players left. Money started at position 43. Of course, from 43 to the final table, the payouts were a pittance. I set my hopes to making the final table, which would be at least ninth. To do this, I tightened way up. I didn't let myself play anything less than jack, jack, queen, queen, king, king, ace, ace. So I folded for a solid hour, including folding ace, king suited when faced with a big preflop raise. So, as I watched my stack dwindle, as the field continually wound down, I lost the most with blinds in the 4K, 8K range with 1K antes. A player with 30 to 40K or more stacks were shoving every hand. I was left with a decision to, 1, call with non-premium hands like queen 10, suited aces, and the like, putting 25 to 30% of my stack at risk against these folks, or 2, fold, waiting for premium hands that never came, and watch my chip leader stack get blinded out. So what's the optimal strategy for cashing here? Should I continue to read this, or should we wait till we're done talking?
Go ahead and read the epilogue.
Well, he says, the first hand of the final table, he was in the big blind with a small stack of 90K, shoved with ace-queen, and was called and wiped out by ace-ace.
Yeah, so I think it was key there to read that epilogue, as he calls it first, because he started the story with 180,000, and then apparently blinded... and folded his way halfway through his stack.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, there might be some play somewhere in there, but he ended up with a stack of 90,000 and then felt forced to shove there, and then, of course, he got knocked out. So I guess what I told him in the email is that I don't tighten up when I'm the chip leader. I don't get reckless. I don't feel the need to be the table captain or the sheriff and knocking people out, but I'm not letting up. Those chips are very valuable at that point. And I wish Dave would have been at Mohegan Sun with me for the Anteup Poker Tour event to watch Brian Altman, our champion, play that final table. He was in every single hand and putting pressure on folks. And, you know, when I interviewed him after the tournament, he's like, I knew exactly. That's what I needed to do. These stacks had to have a big hand to stay in with me when I put pressure on them. So I kept putting pressure on them, and then if they do get a big hand, you still have an opportunity to win, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can flop big or something like that, and if you lose, then you lose a portion of your stack, but not a terribly fatal part of the stack. So you've got to use that chip stack to your advantage. And tightening up, I think, is exactly what happened. How often do you get these? Do you get jack-jack, queen-queen, king-king, or ace-ace?
Right.
You know, I mean, no wonder you're folding for a solid hour. So you got to keep the pressure on. You got to do it responsibly. I mean, you're not going to be in every single hand with every kind of holding in every kind of position, but definitely, I'm putting a lot of pressure on shorter stacks, making them really think hard about continuing to play a hand with me after they've committed a good amount of chips.
Yeah, a good thing to do would have been to figure out what the average chip stack was at that moment when you had 180,000 chips, and then figure out what the average chip stack would have been at that final table if you hoped to get there, and then realize what size stack you were going to have by folding for an hour, and then say, wow, am I going to really be competitive with 90,000 when I get to the final chip, final table, and everyone has 2 million? Right. You know, whatever it is. So I'm just making a point. The other thing, too, is if you are going to play this way and you're playing online, then make sure you use the entire clock for every time before you fold. Because then at least that way people are getting eliminated all around you faster while you're playing slower at your table to try to make your stack last. But I would never do that. I would totally do what Scott said anyway, so...
Oh, the other thing, too, is we were at a money bubble here, right?
Yeah.
Money started at 43, so I'm sorry. The bubble had burst already, so never mind.
Well, he said 40 to 50 left, so you could be right, though. It still could have been 50 were left, and you weren't there yet.
No, he said money started at position 43, so... Oh, that's true. Yeah.
See what I'm saying? If there were 50 players left, he had seven players to abuse
him. So if there was, now I am absolutely making people have an awesome hand to play against me.
Yep, absolutely.
And there are some people, obviously, and he's right, a $2 tournament, we all saw that, you know, where, you know, 43rd place pays $2.01 or something like that, right? So no one really cares necessarily about min-cashing. But a ton of people do, actually. So, I mean, that's the best time to be the chip leader is at the money bubble or any of the next big jumps in the payouts. Mm-hmm. That's when you need to be really active because you've got a bunch of people looking at that and saying, I just got to make it three more people and I get X. And therefore, when they try to open for a pot and you come over the top of them, then they're like, I can't do it, you know, unless they have the big hands.
Yeah.
And how often do they have the big hands? Absolutely. And then if they do have the big hands, let's say somebody that had 30,000 and you got them to commit all your chips and you had 180,000, you lose that hand and you're down to 150. Big deal.
Yep.
Right? And chances are you're not going to lose that hand with any holding. You've got a good chance of winning. Yeah, definitely I would not advocate tightening up with the chip lead almost ever.
Good stuff. Find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. We'll have Hollywood Casino Toledo Director of Poker Elliot Schechter tell you how he would have ruled. Our good friend Frank, who was on the cruise and actually cashed in the fourth straight cruise tournament.
Yes, very proud of that.
Yeah, he did.
As he should be.
Yep. He sends this in. He says, in a casino tournament with 100, 200 blinds, a player raises to 525 by saying raise and putting out a 500 chip and a 25 chip. The next player does not verbalize anything but puts out a 25 chip and a 1,000 chip. I think he probably meant to call 525, but at the same time, make it easy for the dealer to give him a 500 chip as change. The dealer gave him the 500 chip as change and treated it as a call. But isn't this wrong? The initial bet was 200. Then there was a raise of 325 to 525, and then a 3-bet of 500 to 1,025. I see this done all the time in tournaments. The players try to make things easier on the dealer by putting out a combination of small and large chips that makes getting change easier for a call, but on closer inspection, could be interpreted as a raise. If they verbalize call or raise, then there's no confusion, but when they just toss out the chips without verbalizing, it should always be a raise, right?
Elliot says, TDA Rule 46, Multiple Chip Betting, states, quote, when facing a bet, unless raise is declared first, a multiple chip bet is a call if every chip is needed to make the call. For example, removal of just one of the smallest chips leaves less than the call amount. So Elliot continues and says, this is a call according to this rule, as removing the 1K chip from that wager would fail to leave enough to call the bet. The purpose of most TDA rules, but especially this rule, is to prevent anyone from having to determine what a player was thinking as opposed to doing when an action is made. When a bet is made silently, intent and mindset are rarely, if ever, considered because consistency and uniformity would be sacrificed every time we try to put a player on a dot.
Just a little part of a confusion here. I don't want to extend the show too long because of this, but if you remove the 25 chip, the 1,000 is still enough to make the call. It says removal of just one chip.
One of the smallest chips.
So on the smallest chips, okay. Yeah. But it still leaves enough to make a call. If you remove the 25 chip, that 1,000 is enough to make the call at 525.
It's less than the call amount.
If you remove the 1,000 chip, of course, 25 can't make a call. But if you remove the 25 chip, that 1,000 chip is enough to make the call.
Well, yeah. It's a good point. I guess what I was going to add, though, is this does get discussed at TDA Summit quite often. Mm-hmm. And there is a, I would say, a little bit of a divide. I think most tournament directors are in agreement. Please don't try to help the dealer. You know, we're paying the dealer to do the job, right? So you put the proper amount of chips in when you can. Don't worry about the change. You know, once the betting is complete, the dealer is a professional and will be able to look around. And if she needs help at that point, she can ask for somebody for help. But doing so in the middle of the betting confuses people. And as it does here with Frank, you know, I think it makes a good point. You're like, you know, hey, I understand they're just trying to make it easy for the dealer, but when does that cross over into actually doing something that's not intended by the player based on the rules? So I think most of the really good solid tournament directors would ask you all to not try to help the dealer while the action's going.
Yeah. Yeah.
After it's completed, if you want to offer up, hey, I can swap this out with 1,000 chips, you just give me 500, by all means, that's helpful at that point. But in the middle of the hand, it's very, or middle of the betting action, it's very confusing, both to the dealer and to other players. So I get, that's the takeout for me. I mean, we can get into the particulars of all the stuff here if you want, but I think the takeout here is, let's just make your bet. And actually, again, it goes always go back to verbalize. If you're verbalizing, you're fine. But if you are scared of social interaction at the table, try to be helpful after the action is over, not during the action.
Yeah, because, I mean, you can read this ruling the way that he means to intend it. It's just what I'm trying to get.
This is one of the problems with the TDA rules that I have made to people with the TDA, is that they do a lot of these, for examples, that makes the rule hard to understand.
Yeah.
Let's just leave that kind of stuff out and make the rule as clear as possible and not try to over-explain it, because then it gets more confusing. Yeah. And this might be an example of one where it is. That's the problem.
All right. After giving O'Malley a week off, he's back with a new episode. Here we go.
Yeah, we give him a week off, but he never goes on the cruise.
Yeah, I know.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we're playing six-handed $1, $2, no-limit hold'em with a force button straddle. And we are doing things a little differently in that we will be playing along with the big blind while O'Malley plays from the button. So we will be trying to figure out O'Malley's hand. It's early in the night, but it's our regular home game. Everyone bought in for 200 and pretty much has their starting stacks. O'Malley posts his straddle, the small blind folds, and we, again not O'Malley, look down at the 10 of hearts, 10 of clubs. This is a very good hand to play back at a straddle, especially with a shorthanded table. Standard raise has been 3x, and that's what we do, $12. It's folded around to O'Malley, who makes a raise to 25. This could be just a typical straddle raise, but we're just going to call. We don't want to get it all in preflop with 10s and flip for it. There's $50 in the pot, and the flop comes down the 9 of hearts, 7 of clubs, deuce of diamonds. We check with the intention of check raising and are delighted when O'Malley puts in a bet of $35. We min raise to 70. After a short period of time, O'Malley shrugs and says, "Okay, let's go," then pushes his stack into the middle. So, knowing what we know about the way O'Malley plays, what range do you put him on? And what's the move?
It's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at antiupmagazine.com. Our good friend Jeff Hayashi is back this week.
All right.
He says, "Normally I like to play limit games, but there are none going when I arrived earlier than normal at my local San Diego card room. It's about 8 a.m. and there are open seats in a 2-3 no limit hold'em game that went overnight." He says, "Most games tend to play a little wild and crazy when most players have been there all night. As an example, a player two to my left has four racks of red chips in a 100 to 400 buy-in table. I bought in for 300 and sat in the 5 seat, which was the only open seat in the game. After the button passes me, I play my first hand, which gives me very little information on anyone at the table. Button is in the 8th seat in a 9-handed game. C2 calls. C3 calls. C4 raises to $18 and folds to me. And I have Ace of Spades, Queen of Hearts.
I don't like Ace Queen. And in a cash game, if I see people who are eager to play, I have a lot more chips than me, and I have no idea how they play. It's the first hand I'm playing, and I have a razor before me. I might just let that go. People left to act behind me, and it's... Did you say it wasn't suited, right? Yeah, Ace of Spades and Hearts. Yeah, so...
Spades, Queen
of Hearts. To be honest with you, I might just let that hand go. I would really like to... I'm going to be able to see
a
bunch of hands
for
free.
I never like to lie to us, so...
Well, okay, so I'm going to be completely honest.
Being honest at all times.
I might let that go.
You're bluffing.
Yeah. I can recall times where I've been in this sort of a situation and I haven't let it go. But in this situation, I don't know how this table is, you know. I mean, let me get a couple of hands under my belt, you know, unless I got obvious hands I have to play. But in this situation, I might just let it go.
What's funny about this is the next line of the email, he says, Scott and Chris discuss. Scott insta-folds and Chris calls? Question mark?
No. It's funny, because as soon as I saw Ace Queen, I thought of you. I always think of the Derby Lane tournament when I'm standing behind you and you have that Ace Queen. I'm like, what are you doing? But I think there's some wisdom in folding this here, because not only because I said it, but because, you know, you don't really know these guys are going to play. And the button just passed you, so you've got a few hands where you'd have to put a dime in. Get a feel for the table. I mean, what does that raise mean from that guy? How do we not know that that guy never raised the entire time all night while he played, and the only time he raises is when he has ace, king, or better? You know what I mean? You don't know that yet. So at least give yourself a moment or two to play the hand, or play the table, you know?
Well, he is right with me. I'm insta-folding here. I've said this on the show a lot, and it's really been a big leak in my game that I have put a plug in. Is not getting committed to these ace less than king hands when there's a raise in front of me. Now that it folded around to me, absolutely I'm raising every single time with this hand. But we have two callers and a raise to 18 in a 2-3 game. What are we going to beat here? We're never going to feel confident about this hand unless we have like quads or something ridiculous like that. That's never going to happen. So let's just fold. In general, but more especially what you said, we don't have any idea how anybody plays here. So now we're guessing even more than we'd normally be guessing with this hand. It's a cash game. You're not in any pressure to ever play a hand. So let's just take this one off and pay great attention to how the hand plays out, because this is going to be a good situation for you to learn how people are going to play. But, you know, I have absolutely no qualms about folding this.
Absolutely. You fold and you watch and you hope that the guy who raised to 18 goes to showdown. You hope that the people who limped, if they get involved, you find out what kind of hands they want to limp, then call raises with out of position. You find out a lot more information than playing. Because then once you're playing...
I promise you, if it goes to that level, you're almost guaranteed you would have lost this hand.
Sure.
I don't remember this hand. It's been a while since I read it, so... But the times that that guy that raised to 18 turns over ace king are going to be staggering to you.
Yep.
And even if he doesn't have ace king, somebody else here, assuming there's going to be some callers, are going to have some kind of hand that's going to make it difficult for you, depending what happens on the flops.
Yeah. I'm going to fold, you're going to fold, and that's all we would do with this hand. But if I'm going to play it, I would probably call, because I don't know if I want to sit down at a table I have no idea what I'm doing with on the very first hand and re-raise a razor.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. I think if I'm going to play it, I have to raise here, which is another reason to fold it, I think.
Because I don't want to raise. I don't know what that guy's going to do.
Right. So if I call, there's a good chance that the two limpers might still come along, and we don't know who's behind us, right? Before that.
Right.
And I don't want to have this hand four-handed. I mean, if I'm going to play ace-queen, I definitely want to be heads up, right? In case he has kings or something and an ace comes, now I feel more confident or whatever, right? But the problem with raising here is not only may some of these people come along, but this guy could re-raise you, and then if he re-raises you, what are you going to do with this hand?
Yeah.
So again, all the reasons I think are coming back to say fold here and just wait and see what happens.
Yeah, I'm folding.
All right. Hero says, even though with little information and such a big raise, I think this is a standard call. This is an action game, and the player raising is a youngish guy who likes to talk, but that's all I'm going on. All right. Mm-hmm. We'll see where it goes. He says, I call, and he gets folded around to seat three, who also calls, and we take the flop three-handed. All right, well, could be worse.
Yeah.
Flop is the ace of hearts, ten of spades, tray of hearts. And it checks to us.
So even the preflop raiser called. Yeah. That checks. That's weird.
Well, not if he's sitting on pocket aces.
Yeah. Geez, I don't know. I mean, it's so weird. If we'd been sitting at this table for an hour, you know what I mean, and we knew how everybody played, you know, we'd be saying, oh, you got to bet here. You got to protect your hand. You got top pair, second kicker, and there's Broadway and flush draws out there. You got to protect your hand. But we don't know what this guy's like. We don't know what he's doing, so.
But here's the thing is I'm going to find out right now how good my hand is. So there's absolutely no chance I'm checking behind here. I'm going to put a bet out there, and if I get check raised, then I'm going to know, all right, I fell into that trap. But I'd rather fall into that trap now at the price that I'm going to set than later in the hand at a price that somebody else is going to set.
Do you think that there's some deception if we check behind, though? They'll think, oh, this guy was just sitting down eager to play a hand. He doesn't have an ace. Why wouldn't he bet an ace?
Yeah, obviously there's going to be deception. No one's going to know what anybody has, right?
Right.
But the problem is we don't have any more information than anybody else has.
So, yeah, I know, but we have position.
I'm trying to figure out right now is I need to find out information because my hand is not as strong as it should be.
Well, the pot's about 60. What do you think you're going to bet here? 40?
30.
You're going to bet half the pot on the flop.
I could go 40 maybe, but 30 seems fine. I'm not going to bet anything less than 30.
Right. All right. Well, I'm gonna play some.
I mean, here's the thing. If I really think again, I wouldn't play this because I'm thinking he's on ace king or aces or at least thinking that's well within his range, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or even pocket tens maybe is in his range here. So if my bet here is to figure out how strong my hand is, and that's exactly why I'm betting here, I'm gonna put in just enough to get that answer. You put in 10 or 20 bucks, that's not enough. You're probably going to get a couple calls from weaker hands. You put in 60 and you get raised, then why did I put 60 in when I probably could get raised for 30? So I guess that's why I'm thinking 30. I think 30 is kind of the sweet spot here of making people actually have to consider their hand versus betting the minimum amount if I do get raised and have to fold this hand.
Okay, well, what information have you extracted from these guys if they both call?
After I bet the 30?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely none.
And it's and to me, 30 is not enough
but I,
to get information.
I assume that, well, so 40?
No, I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. Because I'm saying I don't know if 30 is enough. At this table, these guys have been playing all night. They probably have big stacks.
But here's the thing. If I don't bet, it's the same situation, right?
Yeah, but you don't have $30 out there.
Well, that's true. But my bet is designed to find out what's going to go on. So I'm hoping either to get some folds or get a raise and have to get out of this. So if they both go call, then yeah, I've committed 30 and not any better off than I was before, other than I do know that both these players are willing to put 30 more into this pot.
Mm-hmm.
So if they either have to have, at that point, I would think they'd have to have an ace, a 10, or a tray. They would have to have some kind of Broadway combination to draw into that or a heart combination to draw into that.
Okay, I'm gonna call.
They're probably gonna raise me, right? And if they have a really big hand, they're probably gonna raise as well.
I'm gonna check. I wanna do something different this time. I'm gonna check.
Okay.
Because I just feel like.
Well, again, neither one of us would have been in this hand,
right?
Anyhow, so I'm just trying now that you know this is again what I'm thinking. If I make a mistake at the table, and it's arguable, you can argue whether Jeff made a mistake here pre-flop or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think you and I think he did. But so I think he did, so that's what I'm acting on. So I'm going to assume if I made a mistake and called this ace-queen, for whatever reason, pre-flop, I don't want to compound the mistake now. I want to try to fix that mistake. And to fix that mistake, I want to be sure that I don't get stacked against ace-king or ace-10 or ace-tray here or whatever. So I'm willing now, even though I made the mistake and put 18 in this pot pre-flop that I shouldn't have, I'm willing to put another 30 in now just to avoid not losing 300, right? That's what he has, 300.
Yeah. So
that's my concern, right?
What you're saying is you don't want to compound your mistake by making another mistake So you're going
to compound my
put more money in the pot when you don't have to.
I don't want to compound my mistake by making a second huge mistake.
So checking is a huge mistake?
Second smaller. No, it's not. It's only a huge mistake if we end up getting it all in and we lose to ace-king.
Well, the only thing I like about the check then is that it makes it very difficult to get it all in on just two streets left of betting. But by betting 30 and getting a call or two makes it very easy to get 300 in.
So, I mean, there could be a bet and a raise and stuff.
Right, I understand. But I'm saying by not putting any money in, you're likely to survive this hand and maybe even have showdown value by having only two streets to bet. You're controlling the size of this pot.
I mean, it's already a $60 pot. There's a case to be made that if this guy is sitting on pocket aces or something like that, by checking here, the pot does not get any bigger, right? So his next bet on the turn will be about what we were
going to put in. Then we can still call, and he gets at a river. There's no way he's shoving on the river for $100 out
there. That's fair enough.
And the other thing, too, is we have to think all scenarios. A lot of times it comes to us to say, hey, why would this guy raise preflop and now check? Is it fishy, or does he have kings and he's afraid of the ace, and now we've got him? So you have to think about all scenarios. It's very difficult. This is why you don't want to play ace queen.
So if you bet here, now if you get him to call with kings, that's a good
It's a good outcome for us. Yeah, but it's also a very finite example. But all right, so you're going to bet 30, and you want to see what happens. I'm going to check. Let's see what happens.
All right. Here is a nice flop. Action goes check, check. It's on me. That's a good sign, although I'm certainly not going to like getting check raised. I think a bet is mandatory here. I bet 40 into the $59 pot after rake.
Mm-hmm.
Seat 3 thinks for about 10 seconds and calls, and the original raiser calls quickly. All right, so we're back to the situation that you just mentioned.
All right, yeah, so instead of betting 30, he bets 40, which is around what we thought you should bet, two-thirds or so, I thought. But if you're going to bet, and now we have no more information other than he called quickly, which means he's on a draw, which we don't really know, because he raised preflop, so what kind of draw could he have? Did he really raise preflop with
king-queen?
Yeah,
here's kind of the problem, is the other guy waited 10 seconds and called. I mean, if we knew these people, the waiting 10 seconds to call and the call quickly would mean something. But
yeah, we don't
it doesn't
know.
Matter. I mean, if somebody could hear the original raiser calls quickly, he might call quickly every hand.
Right.
And the other guy might always take 10 seconds to think. So, you're right. We don't have any other information. This is probably the worst case of my strategy here, is that they both called and I don't know where I am.
And then to add to that, there's 180 in the pot already.
If no one here is confident about their hand, it's going to go check again on the turn, right?
Maybe.
And then we could check behind.
Yeah. Yeah. But you can see now how this you can lose your entire 300 stack now with 180 in the pot going to the turn.
Absolutely.
What I mean? Before it was
never been in this hand.
Before it was 59 in the pot. You know what I mean? But okay, so all right, so it's 180 in the pot. We're going to the turn.
All right, the turn is the 7 of diamonds. So our board is ace of hearts, 10 of spades, tray of hearts, 7 of diamonds, and it does check around to us.
Yay! We're going to not compound this mistake by putting more money in. We're going to check.
Now, obviously, the weakness in the check here is that a heart or a Broadway card comes, and then it gives somebody a license to bluff at it to figure out whether they're bluffing. But I do think I'm willing to take that risk for pot control here because the pot is pretty big now, right?
Yeah, especially for 2-3.
Really, I think the only scenario here where I would bet is if I really thought everybody was drawing. If they're drawing, they put the 40 in to draw, but now they're not going to put what's in the pot now?
Put 90 in now, probably, to bet. So.
Right. I don't think they're going to bet, come along for 90 now. But I don't know if I'm confident that that's where they are in this hand. Certainly,
exactly.
Again, just going off of what quickly calling means. Would mean exactly what I'm worried about, that this guy has a big hand and he's just waiting for us to bet.
Since
we bet the flop, a player might think that we're more inclined to bet the turn as well, too.
So what did he do?
All right. He says, at this point, I would range my opponents with weak aces or flush draws. If they're playing really loose, possible tens and Broadway cards for a gut shot, I bet 120 into the 169 pot.
Wow, that's a lot.
Well, I guess we're going to find out where we are now.
Well, you're pot committed. Now, how could you fold now? I mean, you bet 40 before plus the 18, so that's
stacks in, right?
That's 58. Now you get 178 of your original 300 in. If somebody comes back and makes it all in, you're going to fold and only have, 120 left in your stack? Wow. Yeah, I mean, now you've bet so much. Yeah.
You don't have any really any reasonable expectation of improving here.
I mean, I can't imagine folding now because I mean, you could, but you're going to just bet 120 and fold it? I mean, that's basically committing your stack. Why not shove?
Here's the kind of thing is Jeff is more confident with his spot in his hand than we are, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
And that's fine. As long as you're confident where you are, then that's, you know, I hate to be confident in hand and not bet. That's where you lose value, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, as long as he's confident, I'm just not confident, you're not confident, but that doesn't mean that he can't be confident.
I just don't know where that confidence comes from. It's your first hand sitting with these people.
Well, again, that's also the problem with the hand of the week, too, is we're not sitting there. I mean, it's impossible for anybody to send these things in with every little thing that's going on, right?
Right.
So I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Okay.
All right. Seat 3 thinks now for about 30 seconds and seems to reluctantly call. Seat 4 does the same and mumbles something I don't understand and calls.
Well, now you could never fold.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's 360 plus 180. So, I mean, you got $500 in this pot. You're getting 5-1 on your, or 4-1 on your money, no matter what they do on the end. So you've just basically committed your whole 300.
If nothing comes to complete a straight or a flush, I'm betting again.
Sure.
Because I feel like we have the best hand right now, best made hand right now, right?
I mean, if they check, I might check and say I'm happy.
Oh, no, if it's check, it down. I'm going to check behind.
Yeah.
particularly if a heart or a Broadway card comes out, I'm not going to let them. I'll watch them go, oh, I thought you were going to bet thing, which always
yeah.
me up. You know?
Yeah.
But if it's a blank, I mean, right now, I think I'm really good now. So whatever Jeff's confidence came from, I think it's warranted now. Based on how...
No matter what I do, I can't fold. If they go check, no matter what the card is, I'd probably just check behind. Why? I'd be happy to sit down and take a $540 pot first time I'm sitting there. You know, instead of having this guy say, I'm walking the dog, and this guy just seems so eager to bet. My set, I'm just going to sit there and let him keep betting, and then I'm going to lose that 120 for no reason.
Yeah, fair enough.
But, okay, so what happens?
All right, the river is the 8 of clubs. So final board is ace of hearts, 10 of spades, tray of hearts, 7 of diamonds, 8 of clubs. And let's see. It checks around to us again.
Yeah, I'm just checking. I mean, that completes a straight, a weird one, 9 jack or 9 6, which, by the way, we've seen people play jack 9 for a raise on the cruise ship. So, yeah, I'm happy to check behind and just hope somebody didn't just make aces and eights or... You know, or that we were just getting walked the whole time. This is a huge pot. My first time.
That's the other thing that I forgot. I dismissed here is it could be a weaker ace that paired the 7 or the 8 here.
Right.
Probably the 8.
Yeah, I'm glad
the
check.
Could be the 7 too because they were hoping we were going to bet there and we. Oh no, we did bet though. I think. Oh,
Yeah, I'm definitely glad to check behind.
Yeah. All right. He says, I only have 122 left in front of me, and the pot is 529. He says, I decided to check, but this is probably a spot where I should have gone for some value from a weaker ace. If someone hit two pair, they probably would have shoved on me. Seat 3 shows king of hearts, jack of hearts. Seat 4 shows jack 10 offsuit. So while I dodged hearts, I did manage to get some good value from middle pair.
Well, here's the deal. He dodged the hearts, which we knew someone was drawn to the hearts, either that or Broadway. It seems odd that someone would be drawing the Broadway because only gut shots can get there. So it was obvious the hearts were there, but the other person wasn't obvious. And so even if you make a bet in the end, you're not getting any of that money. So they're going to fold. And no one's going to call tens for 120 more. I just don't see it. Maybe this guy was, I don't know what he was thinking, the jack 10. Didn't believe you, and then maybe he picks up a... No, I guess he didn't pick up anything. I was going to say he picked up a gutter, but he didn't because that's not to the river. I can't imagine
getting
that.
This is a good game to be in, though, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, first of all...
obviously, the King Jack guy with hearts had a lot of outs. He had hearts and Broadway.
And Broadway.
So I could see him calling a 120, but...
But the Jack 10, is that the guy who made it 18? I think it is, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, look at that. Now you've got so much information. Jack 10 made it 18 after 2 limpers with Jack 10 off, and he wasn't even on the button. That's just crazy to me. That's a fine hand right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you bet, you don't get any of that money back anyway, so don't worry about betting.
No, you didn't lose any value at all. I mean, in this particular hand.
Right. And again, I don't think I would have bet anyway, even if I knew what the hands were. I mean, I'm not results-oriented or anything. I'm just saying that I think it's the right move to check behind anyway.
But it's a good point to make that if we put people on draws here and the draws missed, you're not really losing any value by betting there, because a reasonable player is not going to make that call.
Right.
And then if you happen to be wrong for whatever reason, it's a costly mistake that you don't get anything. So you're not getting any value either way. You know, you're only, it's the classic, you're only going to get called by a better hand.
Right. Scenario, classic. I'm Chris Cosenza.
I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@anteupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@anteupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.